It is a pleasure to welcome the three B's here tonight. Bill Buford is an extraordinary and wonderful writer, and it is a great pleasure to welcome him here together with Anthony Bourdin, who runs Les Halles, and also to have Mario Batali here. I have not had the pleasure of eating in either of their restaurants, which is too bad, but I hope after this evening they will invite me. As you all know, Bill Buford was the editor and founder of Granta, and he is the author of a book which now is on the New York Times bestseller list, Heat. It has a wonderful subtitle, An Amateur's Adventures as Kitchen Slave, Line Cook, Pasta Maker, and Apprentice to a Dante-quoting Butcher in Tuscany. And now, without further ado, it is my pleasure to welcome them to talk about food.
I'm in the unusual position of kind of reverting to chef mode here so that this conversation doesn't immediately become a all Batali love fest as something that I've experienced before. So I'm going to try to impose some semblance of order here. Bill, you've written a book about, your own sort of personal journey from desk jockey to line cook. You're talking about the life of the cook, the magic and mystery and the torment of the kitchen, and about Don Mario over here, as well as some other character. Why did you write this book?
That's a lie.
Why Mario, and why? What happened to you that you would want to subject yourself to life in the Babbo kitchen?
I invited him to dinner, and he accepted, and it went downhill from there. I invited him for dinner for my writer. I was having a birthday dinner for the writer Jay McInerney. I was the fiction editor of the New Yorker then. I was a civilian. I had a very good job. I wore a tie, and I got Mario's number from Jay, and told him could he come along to celebrate Jay's birthday, and he said yes, and I hung up the phone and went into the living room and told my wife, and she was apoplectic. She said, oh my God, what are we gonna do now? And sure enough, he arrived, like Santa Claus, bearing a big bag of goodies, including a giant slab of raw pork fat, which he cut into slivers and put on the back of all of our tongues and said, right there in the back, you can taste the pig in the last 3 months of its 750-pound piggy life. Apples and cream and walnuts. And I don't think anyone had experienced anything like that in their lives. And they sort of let the fat dissolve, and they got thirsty, and we drank and ate more fat, and we drank and we ate more fat, and we drank and we ate more fat, and we drank. And then 3 o'clock in the morning, there was our beloved hero playing a...
You're not going to recite the whole book, are you?
And you decided...
Needless to say, it starts like Private Ryan. It's just right. Like 25 minutes of, oh my
and
God.
And this incident led you to decide to become his bitch for 2 years. Why?
Now, I went to the New York...
It was that moment of the lard on the tongue. It really
smoked it. Completely understandable.
Exactly.
I went into the New Yorker the following week and said, so we got to write about this guy. And David Remnick, in his wisdom, suggested that I should write it. And I proposed to Mario that I... One, that the New Yorker wanted to write a piece about him, and he said that was a good thing, and I said, and I'm going to write it, and he thought that was a good thing, and then I said, and I want to work in your kitchen, and he went, ba, 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 I'm not so sure about that. I mean, that's how it started.
Well, actually, it started, quite honestly, Bill got the okay from Remnick and then didn't tell me for 3 months while we were hanging out. Then he started to admit.
Okay, I mean, I thought it was a riveting, compelling, and utterly believable account. I mean, watching him move from, you know, lowly prep dog up the line, I mean, I bought it. Was he any good at all? I mean, at the end of the 2 years, really, was he in any way useful? Meaning, if he showed up at my restaurant...
Useful, yes.
I mean, could...
Really good?
If I trailed him for three nights on grill, could he...
He could pull off the grill. I would tell you, he could pull off the grill on not a complicated menu, but he understands the timing and he does understand the cooking, as he will admit. And
stop
as
there!
I,
stop
and
there! Stop there! There. Thank you! And, yeah!
But as I warned him, the pasta station is a young man's game. And Bill, you're not a young man anymore.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, I'm not working a pasta station.
It's just, it's very difficult, and we're very good at pasta, so the expectations are high, so people order a lot of it. So. It's, you really don't even get the luxury of looking at tickets. You're a short order cook, and they told you about 10 minutes ago what it was going to be, and then they pick it up. And it's literally 10, 15 plates at a crack, and then followed by 10, 15 plates. It's a much more substantial responsibility.
This is the very thing, actually, that Mario told me at the time, because I'd done the piece for The New Yorker, then I wanted to go back and do a book. And in the meantime, I'd done this kind of pasta tour. Actually, Mario's itinerary, my wife and I going through Emilia Romagna and all these wonderful places. And I came back pasta obsessed. And I said, I don't want to work in the pasta station. And Mario said, yeah. No chance.
You can have
and
a
I
try.
Said, Mario, come on. No chance. And oh, come on, Mario. And they let me do it. And, ooh, it
was tough like, kitchen. I mean, physically, it's not the roomiest in New York,
right.
Is it?
I mean, the pasta guy has as much space as anybody else.
Which is...
He has a corner.
Yeah. So you talk in the book about how cooks, professional cooks, don't talk about preparing food. They don't talk about cooking food. They use the word making food. What is that?
Well, the pasta station was a very good illustration. I mean, by that point, I'd gone from kitchen slave to kitchen bitch. And in fact, the pasta machine is called the kitchen, sort of the pasta bitch. And I was always the kitchen bitch cleaning the pasta bitch at the end of the night. But it was Mario's sous chef, Frankie, maybe trying to ease me out of the pasta station, trying to sort of get me back to a place where I wasn't going to make such a fool out of myself, said, you know, pasta, you're just making food that other people have already made, because the pasta is made during the day, and there's all these, you know, wonderful fresh pastas that Babbo sells, and there's all these wonderful ragus, but they've all been done during the day, and what you really want to do is make food. And he said, that's what being in the kitchen is about, is making food. And it made me realize, and then he encouraged me to go back to the grill, mainly to get me away from the pasta station, but it made me realize that there's a deep satisfaction that the restaurant taught me, which is the satisfaction of cooking, and it is actually the act of making food. It's an act involving your eyes and your hands and an actual creation, a plate. And when I was working on the grill station, it was one of my great thrills, is that maybe over the course of the night there'd be 20, 30 plates that were right. And I put it up on the pass and it felt good.
That's a perfect moment, isn't it? When it's in the window before it goes out to the customer.
Before it gets ruined by being eaten.
Right. You know, Bill talks about sort of a food epiphany in the kitchen. He describes the thyme leaves popping in the pan as being a, you know, making him particularly happy.
I believe he got wood.
Actually. Yeah, I was leaving that. Yeah.
I'm not sure if he used it that way, but.
You know, you've been in the restaurant business. You've been playing with food for years and years and years. What's still magic for you? You know, when you bread coming out of the oven, or you know, do you have similar moments still?
Absolutely.
Where would those be?
I mean, when someone who I'm working with comes up with a dish, that I say to myself, I could have almost come up with that dish too. And that we're working together and we have a cohesive mindset in each of the seven kitchens that I work at. And that each one is distinct, and yet each one clearly has the mark of both myself and the chef and the sous chef and the pastry chef. And when all those things come together and you're either sitting there eating it or you're back there helping them or there's a particularly difficult crisis, when a plate of perfect food comes up, it's a great moment. I mean, it's what we do and it's what we live for, and it's what makes the kind of the giving, the hospitality nature of the reason that we like this so much, really kind of whole.
But is there one particular process? Like for me, you know, when you're making pasta, right, and you're finishing it, just ready to come out of the pan onto the plate, that last second when you throw in the olive oil and it kind of sips up. That
one right there is also.
Yeah.
That and the smell of somebody else making French toast. It's a great moment.
What Mario's describing is I didn't write about it.
I'm sorry, freedom toast.
Yes, right.
What he's describing is I didn't write about it, but I had a chance to witness it. When the seasons change, Mario would gather his executive chef, his sous chefs, maybe someone he's his favorite cook at the moment, his pastry chef, and they'd sit around a table and they'd all come up with ideas for how to inaugurate the next season. And
it was quickly too. We like to immediately.
It was fantastic. You know, it was just like cooking riffing, and then somebody would suggest a dish and Mario would invariably say, "Yeah, but add pancetta."
Or take three ingredients out.
Or take three ingredients. That's a very crucial Italian philosophy. Take three ingredients out.
So Mario, what is a chef? I mean, what does it mean? What does it take to be a chef? And does a chef, especially one with as many restaurants as you, should you expect a chef to actually be at their restaurant in every case? I mean,
John Mariani, I'm glad you brought that up.
Oh, yeah.
I think the chef's responsibility in a chef-owned, chef-driven restaurant is to be present in the kitchen. I mean, if you talk to someone like Paul Bocuse, who's asked, you know, who's cooking in your kitchen when you're over here in America, well, the same people that are cooking when I'm standing in the kitchen. And then when you talk to Alain Ducasse, well, how do you do all these businesses? He says, I'm in every kitchen I own, every bit of the day. And it's really more about setting the standard and leading the good guys into the place where they got to go, or the girls, with the food. And although I'm not in every kitchen every day, you could tell that I've been there. And you could tell that Andy's been at Casamono, and you could tell that Frank's at Babbo, and you could tell that April's at the Spotted Pig. There's a kind of a working together process where you have to kind of accept at a certain point that you're not going to step on each other's toes. If something sucks, you say it sucks, and it works out really well.
Well, your operations are generally from the ground up built around your relationship with a particular chef most times. Yes?
All of them.
Right.
As say, Eska, for example. Eska's really Dave's restaurant. I helped him, and we kind of got it rolling. But, I mean, there's very little of me at Eska, and there's not so much of me at Casamono, and there's a lot of me at Babbo, and there's a lot of me at Otto, and you can just tell kind of where I spend my time, but that doesn't mean that it's slipped away in quality. It's gone to further augment itself and become something even better than I would have imagined.
Part of the genius of the way the restaurant is run is that Mario makes room for the chefs as they're growing and developing. I mean, every chef, I mean, you can see it working in the kitchen. You're cooking somebody's food over and over again, day in, day out, year in, year out. And they get frustrated, and usually they go off and go to Lazare, say. But what Mario and his partner Joe Bastianich have figured out to do is they take these chefs as they've been with them for so long, and then find a place for them and allow them in to be equity partners. And everybody knows that if you stick with the program for long enough, you join this much bigger team.
I mean, I got to say what I think, you know, you're doing is part of a larger phenomena, and that for the first time in history, you know, whatever you might think about the celebrity chef phenomena, even at its most annoying, for the first time certainly in American history, chefs are, and I think you've been instrumental in this, chefs are for the first time deciding what you're going to eat next year. I mean, you've created markets. You know, did we know that we needed crudos or you know, Sardinian pizza? Did we know that we needed more offal in our lives?
I think
apparently
we did.
We did. I mean, we knew that, but I mean, for the first time, chefs are empowered to pretty much tell the public that next year it's going to be pork belly because we like it. That's what we eat and we love. And I think, you know, that's, you know, you've changed the landscape of food in New York by, you know, doing that. Where I think a lot of other chefs would have kind of said, well, you know, I'll open up 12 restaurants. They all serve linguine pomodoro. Whack the customers $29.95 and. You know, that's that. You know, you apparently decided, you know, we need more brains in our lives. And you got people
here,
to eat them.
Here.
What do you think, obviously you spent a lot of time with both Mario and, unbelievably, a lot of time with Marco Pierre-White, a chef who, I have to say, in all the chefs I've met in my life, I've never met one, well, if I'd gotten down on one knee and kissed his pinky ring, I don't think he would have found that inappropriate. What do they have in common, given their tortured history? Is there a common thread?
Staggering quantities of testosterone.
Ah, really? You think that's it? That's all?
Mario in his early career, when he tried to go to cooking school and got very bored, found himself working in a pub, if I may summarize your early career in this way.
Again, don't read the book, Bill.
found himself working in a pub with an unknown chef named Marco Pierre White, who's since become the legendary Marco Pierre White and is probably the most famous chef in Britain. And is a histrionic, hysterical, screaming, charismatic, lovely, wild man. And at some point I got it in my head that I wanted to reenact a mini version of Mario's life and be trained by the people who had trained him. And while Marco didn't really train Mario, he inspired Mario. And we spent a lot of time in London hanging out with Marco, who was pretty mad. I mean, just in little things, he was pretty mad. He'd throw a cigarette over the balustrade and it would land in his wife's lap. He'd get excited about a sunset and he'd kick out the windscreen. And once we went hunting, because with Marco he goes hunting, and he pulled a rifle on these men who shouldn't have been there. And I thought, why am I going around with this man always with loaded weapons?
Yeah. I mean, Marco's famously, allegedly very litigious. He is also allegedly, let's put it this way, Gordon Ramsay came up with Marco, and he's a cupcake compared to him. I mean, those were rough kitchens. And I happen to know was a traumatic time for young Mario.
Marco rushes into libel suits, and it is true, I'm not entirely comfortable yet because he's also dyslexic, so I know he hasn't read the book yet. So any moment, once he's gone through the audio version, I might finally hear from his lawyers.
What do you think would have happened if you guys had just really hit it off, you'd for whatever reason really liked working with Marco? I mean, would your feelings about French cuisine be different today?
Well, I think, we would have gotten married and he would be my bitch. I think the funniest thing about Marco Pierre White is that he was cooking French food, but he went down to the wine shop down around the corner to have them translate the menu into French every day because he'd never been there.
Right.
And he still hasn't been there.
Right.
Well, he went to the racetrack one day.
I think he went once.
He went to the racetrack one day.
But he was an inspirational cook who, I never could have worked with him that much longer because it was not my destiny to be the number five or the number six in his kitchen, which is where he wanted everyone to be. But what I did learn from him and what I saw from him the very first time in my life was that cooking is well beyond just putting linguine in a pan and taking it out with a couple of oysters and piling it on a shell like he does. It's a creative and completely personal project that you may or may not be able to be successful with, and he obviously was tremendously successful. I think a large part of his fame was in fact due to the fact that the English people like their rock stars to pee or puke on them. They like to elevate someone who will then treat them badly, and then they take them back down and get rid of them over the next couple of weeks.
I have to say, I remember in, I think, early 80s, when all the notion of the chef, for all the cooks I work with, when we tried to imagine a chef, it was, Paul Bocuse, somebody with a tall hat, probably French. Or there was Paul Bocuse and there was Chef Boyardee. That was the image of the chef. And somebody brought in that book, White Heat. There was Marco, gaunt, burnt
sitting
out.
Sitting with a giant sturgeon on his
earlier, it was him with rings under his eyes, long, scraggly
hair. Chain smoking.
With a cigarette in his mouth in the
while
kitchen.
While he's preparing food, sweat and pouring down his face.
The effect was electric. Yeah, well, it was the first time that all of us thought, wow, he looks like us. We can do this. There's room in this business.
Tony, he looks like you.
Oh. Not anymore, Adon.
He looks more like me now, I think.
For a business that's classically attracted, misfits, refugees, dreamers, dyslexics, huge number of chefs are dyslexics.
Well, I've always liked to say, up until the mid-70s, becoming a chef or a cook was the last thing you did on your way out of the military, on your way to jail.
Yeah, but
it's changed a bit since then.
Is there a common... I mean, in your interviewing process and in doing Heat, I mean, did you find any common thread other than, testosterone? I mean, for God's sake.
No, Marco was interesting that way because he really can't read. And he would have been a failure. He's one of these people, in the same way that sort of like strong, strapping guys become boxers and they couldn't have been anything else. Marco probably couldn't have done much else except what he did in the kitchen.
Yeah, but I mean, Gordon Ramsay's like that as well. But I mean, they both entered a business where we wear aprons and clogs and do essentially what our mothers did. We cook, and we paint little pictures on plates. We nurture people. So, My feeling is that people who are from the beginning uncomfortable with other aspects, certain aspects of their life, naturally gravitate towards a business where they can do things with their hands, their senses. Am I off base here?
Totally on.
Which is, I think, the point that I got out of Marco is that he was a person who did everything with his eyes and hands, and that was the great satisfaction for him, was making plates. And in London, they say you can always tell a plate that Marco's put together. If a runner comes it out, you can tell when he's in the kitchen because he's got that amazing visual sense. And I think that's what makes a great, great cook, is that amazing visual sense. Mario's got a great guy in his kitchen.
That's a lie.
He's got a great guy in his kitchen. Frankie, who's a very similar kind of beast, who just so visual and so physical and so fast. But words are not his thing. Mm-hmm. Words are not his thing.
Okay, you worked in, as you described in Heat, you worked with home-style pasta makers, a Dante-quoting butcher, learning how to break down pork and do wonderful things to it. What was that like, and would any of the people you met in Italy ever have any hope of being on Food Network?
Dario would.
Oh, completely.
But he can cook.
Well, he's a butcher. He makes soppressata. He makes a giant head cheese that's as big as a golf bag and this big around. And it's just lying there on the counter. And you walk in and he's elevated on a marble stage with the opera music in the back. And he's got one of those little cravat things going on. And he's a handsome guy. And he's just the most golden Italian hospitalitarian. You walk in there and it's just like, just love the guy no matter what. No matter before you even taste his magnificent food. He would be made for Food Network.
He's really?
Maybe
huge.
He would be a game show.
He has an accent.
He's a huge.
Oh, he has an accent.
They don't like that.
He has a Tuscan
they?
Accent. He speaks 10 words of English, and all of his S's and C's. Hard C's are. It's amazing to hear him speak. It's like it's literally like you're speaking to someone in the Medici family. It's just like.
So you know what you're doing with the pig now? If I threw you a whole pig and a knife, you know what to deal with?
Well, you know, I had my pig moments. And my wife and I had a pig moment bringing one home on the Vespa, which we were able to learn from Dario in that. We went there for 2 weeks. I mean, the idea was, Mario was always saying, you know, if you really want to learn Italian cooking, you have to go to Italy. And I learned an enormous amount at Babbo. But finally, I was in an Italian restaurant in America. And all the cooks knew that, you know, if they really want to learn this thing, they've got to go there and learn the touch or the sense of simplicity. Really, it's the sense of simplicity. You can go to an Italian restaurant here, and you can look at the menu, and you can tell immediately whether the chef has been to Italy or not.
Even once for a day.
If he...
It's true.
Mainly from how much, you know, he hasn't been to Italy if he's adding a bunch of junk to the thing. It's your take out the three ingredients philosophy. And I went for 2 weeks. I phoned Dario out of the blue. I said, I'm a friend of Mario Batali. Accidente. I said, I know Armandino Batali. Accidente. I know Faith Willinger. Accidente. I said, come. And we went for 2 weeks and came back for a birthday and thought, damn, we got to go back. And we went for another month and got back and went, damn, we got to go back. And then I was there for 6 months.
So is he full of shit or can he cut meat?
He can cut meat slowly.
All right.
He knows what it's called and he knows how to get there.
Is it necessary, indeed necessary, as you suggest, to have a belly to make pasta correctly? To you know, you were talking about the kind of tuck and roll?
This is one of the lessons, probably the most important lesson that I learned from Betta. Betta was the first person to teach Mario, I believe I'm correct in saying, how to make pasta, handmade pasta with a wooden roller on a wooden board. And the trick is stretching rather than pressing. And it's true, she taught me the belly trick. And the belly trick is you kind of press your belly against, you know, with some bellies it's a little more wieldy than others.
Betta didn't have a belly.
I'm just repeating what she said. I mean, to my mind, she had a belly. It was a different belly from my belly. It was a different belly from your belly. But better, you press the little lip of the pasta on with your belly against the board, and you stretch it out.
Yep. Let's put it this way. There are a couple of things where you actually prepare something for someone to put in their body. And one of them is making pasta.
Yes. I told you I wasn't going to.
Exactly.
Okay, Mario, you have, what, how many restaurants now?
Six and a half.
You're opening in Vegas, right?
Two restaurants next December.
In Los Angeles?
One restaurant.
Got the Vineyard thing going on in Italy?
Yep.
Got the NASCAR?
Spotted Pig's not really my restaurant, but I go there a lot.
Okay. I mean, life presumably is pretty good. You've, as I said, you've changed the entire restaurant landscape in New York and, you know, maybe America. Theoretically, I mean, I'm guessing you've probably got enough money to spend the next 6 months on an island someplace running around in a Speedo.
What? Purple butt floss, Tony. Oh, yeah. Come on.
Why do you keep doing it? When's it going to stop? Are you ever going to, like, just, you know, kick back? And
that's a question I often hear. And I don't have that answer. Basically, the reason we open new restaurants at this point is for 12 years I've been in New York City, 14 years I've been in New York City. And as I find really talented people, I say, stick around, there'll be a slice of the pie. Well, there's like four pies still left out there of people that are really have worked hard for me and with me and are ready for their own project. And one of those is Zach Allen, who's going to be the executive chef in the Las Vegas stuff. And he started as a line cook coming out of some French restaurant like La Reserve six years ago.
It was La Reserve.
And the most important thing I can say about Zach Allen is that in the middle of the interview for the line cook job at Lupa, he fell asleep. And I said, hire this guy. He's relaxed.
Sounds like me.
And he's going to be the king of the Las Vegas, two great restaurants in Las Vegas that he can run. And he'll be able
to do it. Whether he's awake or not.
Now he knows how to wake. He's medicated at this point. He knows how to take care of it.
All right, I'm buying the personal loyalty thing.
Why did you quit? Do you ever want to go back?
You know.
Maybe what you're asking, Mario, is...
Yeah, but I mean, when I wrote Kitchen Confidential and for a few months afterwards, I was standing on my feet in the... I was working the lunch sauté station. Serving 150 lunches, standing around and expediting every day, working around 14 hours. I mean, if you're asking me, would I rather be doing that than bitching about the thread count at the Four Seasons in Singapore? I'm milking the celebrity chef thing, for all I can get. And I know when to cash out. I appreciate that there are people who've done right by you, who I understand the creative urge. But, I mean, are you addicted to the adrenaline? And I mean, I've seen you hopping from restaurant to restaurant around New York, checking your food costs, seeing how things went. I mean, is it an addiction? Are you...
Well, let's put it this way. Addiction, whatever. It's fun. I like what I do, and it's great. And believe me, the celebrity chef thing aside, we're lucky to be successful business people at what we do, and what we happen to do is something that we really like, and it's something that also very rarely presents something to me that's unfathomably difficult to figure out or deal with. Mm-hmm. So in a small little way, we're kind of in charge of our destiny, and what I have in probably the most simple way, I have absolute freedom. There's no better job than mine. I can do whatever the fuck I want, whenever the fuck I want to do it at work. That's pretty good.
But I mean, sitting under a palm tree with a mojito for six
months. I can do that,
that's not doing it for
that
you.
That won't do it for me.
All right, what about you, writer guy? Now that you've had... now that you've had a serious taste of the life. I mean, one of the great things reading your book was early on, he's describing characters who he meets, and you get a full paragraph on him. By the end of the book, he meets a character, and he describes him as dickhead. I mean, I'm not saying you're one of us, but you're getting there.
Closing in on it.
I mean, the latest New Yorker, you're doing the pastry article. I mean, is this a strange, an addictive compulsion that might never end?
It might never end. It might never end. I'm never going to be like you guys, but... there's no question that working at Babbo or slaving at Babbo or doing whatever I was doing at Babbo changed my life. And it changed my life because it's what Mario describes. I found I was having a lot of fun. A lot of it was I enjoyed being stupid and curious. And as long as I can be stupid and curious, stupid about a lot of cooking but curious and wanting to know how to do it, then I'll probably stay in this in some kind of way. And now I've got a very nice gig at The New Yorker where... they encourage me to be stupid and curious.
I got to say, I understand completely what you're saying. I mean, I feel that way about travel.
In a way, that's kind of what you're doing.
Yeah.
We're both stupid and curious.
Yeah. Yeah, and I feel that way about travel.
What I'm loving about your book is that it's full of ideas I'm going to steal.
Oh, well, feel free. I like, for me, traveling, it's great to be forced to learn things. You know, every time you go to a new country, you are essentially stupid to try to...
I mean, in a way, you've become our sort of modern food anthropologist. I mean, you're going to all these places, and you're on the verge of discovering... It's as if you're just on the verge of discovering a kind of universal truth about food.
Really?
Well, I have a question.
It's really all about me.
Having a good time. It's mostly about him and Asian women chasing him in Korean airports. But
no,
isn't there a certain point when you get to the end of the week and you're like, I don't really want to eat another bat ball?
Yeah, this is a problem on the road, especially in Asia, because they see the show out there. It's very,
they know
very
you.
Popular.
They save you the special bit.
Yeah, here he comes. When I hear the words something very special, it's like, oh. Penis again?
Scrotum, my favorite.
What were you eating in Namibia a couple weeks ago?
Staying with the Bushmen, they don't grow anything. They don't herd or raise cattle. They're essentially been doing hunting and gathering the same way for over 10,000 years. And they don't even have feathers on their arrows. They creep up on animals within 30 feet, shoot them with these poisonous arrows, track them for 2 days across the desert. There's no water, there's nothing, maybe the occasional berry or fruit or Kalahari truffle. There are truffles in the Kalahari. They're not like white Italians or black, but they're quite nice. 90% of their diet is...
What do you eat them on?
Yeah, well, pretty much their cooking method is dig hole in ground, you know, throw object in. So here I'm honored guest. Their entire tribal hierarchy is based on the, you know, getting of meat and the distribution of meat within the tribal group. So when the chief saws the warthog head off, throws it into the sand, you know, onto the fire, covers with sand, zips open the abdomen, scoops out around 20 pounds of crap onto the ground. Of course, I'm honored guest, the last foot of intestine, which he's squeezing out with the same hands, he's just, you know, onto the fire, and, you know.
That's the part.
Yeah. 2.5 days, there was not a single mouthful of food that I ate that did not have sand, fur, or crap in it. Yeah, it's good to be me.
You got a good game, baby. And I thought mine was good.
The glamorization of chefs, this whole celebrity chef thing, is this some sort of twisted food porn, people staring at the tube, seeing people do things on camera that they're not going to be doing themselves anytime soon?
Absolutely.
Is this a good thing for society, that the celebrity chef thing, even at its, you know, most satanic, like Rachel Ray, would that...
I was wondering when the insults were going to start popping out.
$40 a day, sure. Tip, bitch! Anyway, what was I saying? I'm a bitter man.
I'm glad you said that.
Is it a good thing?
Absolutely.
Even when you've, you know, looked deeply into the most horrifying examples, is it a good thing for society and the world?
Tony, you've answered the question. It's obviously a great thing.
I think we're in a luxury position where we can afford to think more about our food than actually having to actually grow it or eat it. And with that ability becomes the necessarily elevation to a certain art form. And cooking has become an art form that has, in a lot of people's minds, replaced, sadly, some of the more traditional art forms. It used to be you go to the opera and you get a bite. You go to the game and you get a bite. You go to the concert and you get a bite. Now people can obsess about just going out to dinner as their entire evening. And that people think about that certainly works for me. But it's also a sign, it's a sign of a certain luxuriousness of our society, which will obviously mean that one time we'll hit the wall, crash and die.
Yeah.
There's a footnote to that, which is, you know, there probably hasn't been a moment in our history when we've known as little about food as we do now. I mean, and a lot of the interest in what goes on a Food Network channel is born out of ignorance. And it's the thing I think I learned from being with the butcher in Italy is that so many of us are meat eaters, but we've got no idea of the animal that the meat comes from. not even how to kill it, but even like what the pieces are from. And what it is and what you're meant to do with it and to look at it, and they're horrified and that there's blood and that there's organs and that there is a stomach and you got to squeeze out the intestines if you're going to put your sausage meat inside.
Well, and presumably wash it, too.
That's a good point.
That's really a plus, let me tell you.
Didn't sound like there's a lot of extra water. And one of the things that came out of my experience of working in the butcher shop was coming to understand where my food comes from. And that could be the seasonal foods and knowing how to cook seasonally, but a lot of it was knowing what meat is. And if you're going to be the meat eater, I want to know that my meat comes from an animal and want to understand the animal and what's a good animal and a bad animal, what's good meat and bad meat. And I that's a kind of very fundamental kind of knowledge, and I think very, very few people have it. And that kind of ignorance, I think, informs our fascination with food.
Speaking of organs, what about Charlie Trotter and the foie gras thing? Gutless punk or not?
At some point, you have to realize that you're at the top of the food chain, and there's really not much to deal with.
I mean, what does this mean for us? They've just declared foie gras illegal in Chicago to eat, to prepare, to sell.
See, that's the government gone wrong. There must be something they can fix in Chicago besides the foie gras.
But Tony,
and what's
your view?
Gutless punk, I can tell you right now.
Bad thing. Really,
because?
Really.
Because?
I'm very angry at Charlie. I mean, this is a chef of enormous stature, importance, and ability, and I think by coming out against, regardless of his personal view on the matter, he provided political cover for the forces of evil and darkness to take our foie away. What
fuck
next?
Them.
What next? I mean,
so right. I mean, if you think
next
about
it's
it,
our
well,
genes.
We don't treat veal or chickens that well either. So I mean, in the end, are we going to outlaw all the things that we grow to eat?
Did you read the Whole Food thing? Whole Foods is talking about taking lobsters, and they're worried about their soft shell crabs and their clams, and there are actually people writing them and telling them you should take the poor clams out of the tanks. They're being treated badly. I mean, you know, we're force feeding people for Christ's sake, and people are suffering in every variety of means. Battery chickens, for instance. We're worried about mollusks.
Well, there's so much light in those poor little caves.
It just seems wrong. And I mean, I see it as on one hand, we have chefs empowered for, you know, whatever reasons we've discussed here. But on the other, there are people taking our foie gras away who are trying to make food health and safety laws much more restrictive. Who's going to win in the end? Is there hope for us? Are things going to get better?
Yes.
Yeah, are you as optimistic?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
No, hold it. You're the pessimist today?
No, there is, as long as... You know, you're out there, Mario. There is hope for this world.
Exactly. Thank you very much. And you.